Thank you. So in our search for principles, I today will add the role of fluid flows in shaping morphology. And I will look at those places where flows are most abundant in life, which are flow networks of vascular systems. So all higher forms of life, it's a key building block that you have flow networks to transport resources across extended organisms. And despite our perceptions of these networks being static, they're actually highly dynamic in their morphology. And I want to give you just an example from our everyday life, or I mean, hopefully not your everyday life, which is we look at your brain microvasculature. And you're unfortunate and one of your vessels clogs. So your blood flow goes down. But you're lucky, actually, in the end. And after a short while of clogging, the clog unclogs. Yet, despite this clog being gone, data shows that your blood flow velocity only goes back up to 70%. What happened? Well, what we see in this example is that the vasculature actually responded to the change of flow in changing their morphology, dilating, constricting vessels in your brain. So this is an example of how flows and morphology actually feedback on each other. And the key idea underlying this feedback is that flows themselves are information. So if we zoom into one of these network tubes, then just by the mere presence of flow, the flow can provide information. So the flow provides a shear force on the tube wall. The flow comes with a hydrostatic pressure that's acting radially. And the flow can also be transporting signaling molecules along it. And now we're looking at these cues of information in a setting where the tube walls are alive. And so they can respond to this information. Let me draw another example. Now we look at, you know, a single tube. And the tube is responding to the shear force, and it dilates. So by the mere dilation of that one tube, the flow in that one tube changes, because now it's wider. But it's not only this one tube, because if we zoom out back into the whole network, actually, if we look at an incompressible fluid, the flows throughout the network are coupled. And so the dilation of that one tube actually changes the flows throughout the network. And, you know, when the flows are information, that also means that, again, you know, the shear force in other tubes will have changed. And so you can see how a feedback between flow and morphology of networks can unfold. It should be on.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to understand this feedback of flows and morphology. I want to understand how flows are controlled in these networks. What is the role and the impact of adaptability? So how much control resides in the change of that one single tube dilating, what I call adaptability. What is the role of the topology, the loopiness of a network in driving this feedback? And what is the role of the hierarchy of bigger and smaller tubes, bigger and smaller and radii in this network? Today I will take you on a journey throughout this, and starting with a story on flow control. When looking at this outline here, you will notice that these all look, you know, similar. They are all derived from one organism, which is my model system. It's a slime mold called Fusarium polycephalum, which behaves as a single giant cell, which you will appreciate when you see Fusarium here foraging around in an arena with bacterial food pellets as food sources. Note what you see here is dynamics of these giant cells on the scales of, in total, over 3 days. So what you see here is that this giant cell has a network structure as a body plan. Indeed, so Fusarium grows as a syncytium, so you have multiple nuclei, they're enclosed in a single envelope that happens to have a network shape. And if we zoom into this network, we see that within these individual tubes, we have a shuttle flow of the enclosed cytoplasm. And this shuttle flow is driven, if you look up here, by radial contractions of the tubes. So basically, what you see there is you have an actomyosin cortex that is lining the tube walls. And this actomyosin cortex undergoes rhythmic contractions. And these rhythmic contractions are driving fluid flow just by mere displacing the fluid volume. Just a little bit more background on Physarum. So Physarum has actually been, it's a classic genetic model organism, which had its heydays in the 60s and 70s. Been used for as a model for cell cycles, cell development, differentiation, migration. In the sort of course of us focusing on a range of, say, 14 model systems in the 80s, 90s, funding ceased. And it only sort of got resurrected as a model system in the last 10, 15 years, which is actually, it got resurrected in Europe and in the US as a model system, but it actually always was a model system in Japan. And that's a fun anecdote of science, because so while funding for Physarum ceased in the other Western countries, in Japan, researchers were still allowed to work on Physarum because actually at that time, the emperor of Japan was into slime molds. So, I mean, you don't want to be the emperor of Japan, I'm pretty sure. I mean, you know, so he's living in this pretty, you know, isolated world. And so in his summer palace, he would have a great big forest, and he would go and look out and study slime molds himself. And so there's actually a slime mold called Imperialis after the Emperor of Japan. I mean, they didn't dare using his name. I mean, it's still slime mold, but you know, it's still it's a, you know, how the greater things of world can actually impact science. And so it's due to these Japanese researchers that Physarum sort of was kept in our consciousness and actually drew me very much into looking into this as a system. And
those,
so
those are nuclei we see?
No. The nuclei are like, so this, just to give a scale, so this should be 100 to 200 micrometers. So what you see here are vesicles, but the dark spots actually will, so this is a specimen that's been fed off on oat flakes. So these will be like grains of oat flakes that the organism took up while feeding, and that they are like being flushed around for food.
Thank you. And where are the
nuclei? The nuclei are everywhere. So if you do a DAPI staining, you see them like, so in this cross section, you will already see like what seems to be hundreds of nuclei, and they are actually being flowing. They're also flowing around with the cytoplasm. Okay. I mean, there are lots of like intriguing facts about
Physarum. So they're not anchored.
No. So they're really flowing around. They undergo synchronous duplication. Given that this organism can grow even up to scales of, so it actually hit the Guinness Book of Records, yes, and in the late 80s for growing a 3 square meter sized single cell. So, I mean, basically, it depends on the effort you want to put in, but you basically can grow it to gigantic sizes. I've seen not Physarum, but other slime molds, Plasmodium slime molds in the forest that would crawl on wood bark, and they would be really that big in size. So it does take make use of the variation in size as in its natural habitat.
Can you cut off a chunk of a slime mold and take it in interest of?
Yes. So the fun for me as a physicist looking at the system is that I can look at the entire network. So I have full information about the flows and full information about the flows and actually the dynamics of the tubes. And that allows me, as I'm going to show you, to actually calculate with theoretical models the flows, and having the flows calculated gives me access to also the pressures. So I have full control over, I have full access to quantify the physical properties of the system. And four more, the flows, as you will see, they scale with the size of the system. So I even have an entirely non-invasive way of changing the fluid flows in the system, because I can choose to look at a specimen that's 500 microns, or I can choose to look at a specimen that's, I mean, we usually don't go much bigger than 2 centimeters, to be honest, because that's what fits under the microscope, but in principle you could go even larger, and so you can vary these flow physical properties in a not very non-invasive manner.
So these synchronous nuclear divisions, yeah, are accompanied by a change in the size of the organism or not?
This is a citation from literature, and we've always been curious. We're trying to transfect Fusarium, and the first thing would be to do histone labeling for me as a great tracer of flows, but also I want to see this, like in life, like in real life. This has not been done. But so they've been very, as I said, it's a classic model for like classic genetics, so there have been very careful experiments that this statement can really be made, but I would still assume that when I say synchronous to you, that you assume synchronous, whereas a geneticist might also say synchronous to something that's propagating in a wave within like 5 minutes, right? Wow. So I guess it's a little bit of like, you know, how do we define this word? But as I said, like it's a matter of looking at the system. At you?
So even if the physics which is moving the cell, it's much different, isn't it surprising that the overall shape of this moving cell, it seems like one of these angle cells that we have, which are very broad at the front and very narrow at the back. So the physics is very different, but the shape seem and the way it moves seems very similar. Is there some common, I don't know.
So if you look at, so the genome's been sequenced 4 years ago, I would say. And so if you, it belongs to the class of amebozoa. But if you actually look at the genome, it looks very animal-like. So it's surprisingly animal-like. And the word slimewalt shouldn't trap you, because the word slimewalt comes from basically its foraging dynamics that very much resemble what fungi do, but that doesn't mean that they're like genetically actually related. They're much closer to animals. So as I said, like yes, indeed, like if we think about these the basic building blocks, we're here looking at a weirdly shaped actomycin cortex. But in the end, it, like on small scales, if you look at smaller specimen, it doesn't look too much different from the migration dynamics of, say, a neutrophil, right? So where you have also like mini peristaltic contractions driving the migration. So there is definitely a lot of crosstalk. Was another question?
Yes, whether you have any control, maybe you'd be talking about that, on the topology of the network.
So the first question that arises when you think about, I mean, I gave it a little bit away already, but if you look at these contractions arising everywhere, the question that struck me first is how the hell are these contractions coordinated across an organism? And so to do that, we actually look at the organism on a much shorter time scale. So this movie is now about an hour long, or even 2 hours long. And you will see that the network morphology on the time scales of a few hours is very static. So it allows us to really map out the contractions on the core of this network. And what we did here is actually we cut the specimen to size. So you can control for the size, you can control for the sort of the aspect ratio of your network, and by modulating your basically the nutritional state or the stiffness of the underlying agar, you can also control for the morphology of like how much hierarchy of bigger and smaller veins you have, and a little bit the structure. So how does it? So, and that's a good way actually to exemplify how we work. So we take the sprite field data, and then what we have access actually to is, within this entire closed network, we can image the amount of transmitted light at every single pixel in this network. And the amount of transmitted light through one of these tubes is really inversely proportional to the tube diameter. So I have direct access to the contractions throughout the network. And so when I now map out these contractions, I can then quantify any desired observable, which in my case actually was the phase of the contractions. So here you see from...
What resolution do you have?
A time resolution. I think this one was...
Space resolution and diameter of your...
Oh, so that's the key. So, like, I'm not limited by pixel resolution because I don't measure the diameter. I mean, I measure the diameter too, but that's pixel resolution limited. But basically what I use is the dynamic range of my microscope in resolving changes in the ray value of my transmitted light.
Yeah, yeah, but then what kind of a resolution you get by looking at the transmitted light? Spatial resolution. Yeah, because you said the more light you get, the thinner is the...
Yeah, so basically the range is such that I read out every basically every pixel, and then just to for efficient handling of data, we actually map the contractions on the skeleton of this network, so that in the end we have a skeleton and the dynamics that averaged across the tube diameter, which we actually measure. And mapped on that single pixel. That reduces just the sheer amount of data. I mean, it's like two hours every 6 minutes, typically actually every 3 seconds. That's a huge chunk of data if you want to deal with it. So if you just map it on a skeleton, you go from, I don't know, 600 times 600 to like 4,000 data points per frame, and it's much more efficient in handling. So we take this data and then I'm taking the contractions and I'm mapping you out the phase of the contractions. And so you now see here from the phases that what we actually have here is a traveling wave of contractions that's sweeping through the organism. And now, as I said, like I can actually go into this network and I can cut out a piece and I could put it back on the microscope and I will see that the phase of the contractions will have rearranged again, forming this peristaltic wave that matches organism size. So we find a contraction wave that matches organism size on various scales of the network. I'm showing you this because it's the most striking, because it's our biggest specimen that we quantified that way, where across the entire length, we have almost 22 centimeters. And that's rather striking, because it basically tells me that the actomyosin that's driving contractions over here is by some means keeping in a checked phase relationship with the contractions over there. And on that large scales, that's pretty surprising. So I will show you how we can understand how this long-range coordination can actually arise. I would like to take a quick detour and show you how, like, if I just take this phase pattern, and I use it to calculate the flows in the network, that these flows are actually very efficient in transporting. So this is now simulations, and I'm looking at the dispersion of a cloud of particles that was starting out from here. And you see now that really this wave of contractions are very efficient in mixing out particles throughout the network. And that's...
Do you have any inflow boundary condition anywhere?
No.
That's just...
The organism is closed.
Okay.
There is no inflow. There's no...
So there is intake, but just of nutrients, not of water.
There's... yes. So, I mean, on the timescales that I'm looking at here, the mass of the system, of the organism, does not change. So it will change, like, when it's taking out food or when it's starving, over the scales of multiple hours. But here I'm looking at the timescales of... Well, actually, I could look at 20 minutes, right, and I would have the same data. The contraction period, sorry, I should have mentioned, was 100 seconds, typically. So I'm showing you this because, okay.
Sorry, when you cut out a piece, it's self-healing, lipid bilayers, basically?
Yeah, so the first thing is, like, this cytoplasm is, like, super rich in actin. And so what happens, basically, it's the organism's touch sensitive. So even if you just would poke it with your hair, it would immediately gelate the cytoplasm at that spot. And so it's basically this healing, is the precursor is really the gelation of the cytoplasm, and then it really rapidly heals. You have to play tricks to actually get it to leak.
And how does it take up the oat flakes?
It engulfs. So it will actually happily take up pretty much wherever. So we and not showing that data, but we get it to take up fluorescent beads as well. So just nice. So the reason why I'm showing this here is because I, at the time, I was lazy. And I was lazy in that sense that when I wrote the simulation, I took all tubes in this network to have the same base radius, which is not true, because you saw that there was some hierarchy in the network. And so there was a wonderful intern at the time joining me at Harvard, and so she now took on the task to actually, that's the same data set, I'm sorry, she just rotated it by 90 degrees, but it's the same data set. Now here we can actually compare, given that the total volume of the networks are the same, this is where all tubes have the same radius, and this is now taking into account that there were actually bigger and smaller tubes. So if we now run this one, so this is basically the, you know, that's a reminder of the last page slide. And now we look at it with the actual hierarchy. And you see that it's much quicker in having a transport around and also in the different scales. So I'm just showing you this to drive home that the hierarchy is actually having an impact on at least the transport capabilities of the network. So just to keep that in mind. And lightly topology as well. So and now, after this short detour, I would like to return to this question, okay, so how the heck do I actually get contractions to be coordinated on a scale of 2 centimeters? And I basically started this whole talk with a pitch that flows are information, right? So if flows are information, is there a way of how I can figure out which means of information is actually read out in the system? And indeed, there is, because if I would like to transport a new piece of information, actually the speed by which this information is being propagated in a network is vastly different across these systems. Because basically, a shear force or a pressure wave, they would propagate with speed of sound in the network, whereas transport of particles, for example, would be much slower. And so if I now have a mean to follow how information propagates, I can in turn deduce which mechanism is propagating the information. And so that's now what Natalie, Andrew, and what she did is now she put down a drop of sugar here, which is known to be an attractant food stimulus for Fezarm. And what it does is it increases the amplitude of the contractions. And so we now deliberately put down the stimulus to be localized. So to look at how fast does this localized information, hey, rank up your amplitude, propagate into the network. And so again, you know, I'll take the contractions and I map out now to you the increase in amplitude. So bright yellow is where the amplitude went up a lot after the stimulus compared to before the stimulus. And so now you see here the amplitude is going up and it's propagating in. Do you see how it's even taking the big veins as highways to like get into the network? So that's actually already a big hint. But then we actually quantified these waves. And I don't know why this slide doesn't show. It probably should. But what you would have seen here is a comparison of the velocities of action potentials, elastic waves, and then actually in the end, the speed that we measure, which I'm going to tell you now in words, which are 2 orders of magnitude slower than any pressure wave would be, but actually in sync with the transport of molecules. So this increase in amplitude, this information propagates by the means of advecting some signaling molecules with the fluid flows. On you know these timescales where we look at the coordination of contractions, which is typically a couple of minutes. So I want to hold on to this idea now, that you have a mean to propagate information, which is like having just signaling molecules that are flowing around with these flows, which, you know, are really actually good need to mix up the system. And so I'm now taking this to embark on a theoretical project with Jean de Yenvian, who, and that's why I had strong opinions of actually telling this story in this. So he took part in this course that you all, like, well, the students are taking part in right now. Must have been 3 years ago, right? Yeah, 3 years ago, himself. And so what we do now is what we attempt to couple the contractions of the tubes with the flows. And so we're basically building the model on what's known in literature about the mechanics of actin cortices. And this is just a very short list of what actually is out there. So we take the tube wall having a viscoelastic restoring stress. We take into account that the actin cortex undergoes contractions when calcium is driving, when calcium concentration is high. And we take into account that there are stretch-activated calcium inflow. So basically, if the tube is stretched, calcium flows in. Calcium flows in, the tube contracts, calcium is recycled, taking up again, and the tube relaxes. And so you can actually write that down as a concept for an equation for the calcium dynamics, which is basically deriving the stretch, stating the stretch activation and the basic cycling. Now, these contractions are driving, displacing the fluid. So the fluid flow actually then arises, and that's basically Stokes equations, due to the elastic and the contractile stress acting on the tube. And the flows themselves, due to conservation of mass, which is what's stated by this equation, then define the tube radius. So basically, if I sum up these equations, the U goes in here, I basically have two equations, one for the tube radius, one for the calcium. And now, the only new piece of information that I'm adding to this model is that I'm saying the calcium is actually being transported with the flow that the contractions are generating. This is it. It's the new piece that I'm adding. And so I add transport of calcium, and then I have two equations for calcium and the tube radius. And it seems that you have to bear with me throughout the talk because parts of my slides, which never happened to me before, they don't want to be displayed on the screen. I'm sorry. But the essential part is... Okay, anyway. So now you have a set of equations and you can analyze it. And you find that there's actually, in the phase space, there is a region that you would have seen here where the contract, where you actually find traveling waves. And so you can simulate the dynamics over time along now a single tube. We just look at a single tube within the model. And you find traveling waves. So we're good, right? You solved it. Like, you know, this coupling gives rise to traveling waves. But if you build models, you should always make sure that A, you check your dimensions, and B, you put in physiological parameters. So we did this, right? You put in the physiological parameters, and you find that actually there are traveling waves, but the traveling waves have an intrinsic wavelength that's only 7 millimeters. And 7 millimeters and 2 centimeters, that's quite a gap. So something went wrong here. To show you what went wrong, let me explain what it means that my system of equations has an intrinsic wavelength. So it means now I'm here showing the tube length as of normalized by this intrinsic wavelength and also the measured wave size that forms in the tube. So what it means now, if I take a tube that's half the intrinsic wavelength, the pattern that was self-organized form will be exactly size of the will form a wave that's exactly size of the tube. So it's half a wavelength scales. But if I take a tube that's bigger, then this pattern will fall apart, and I will have 2, 3, 4, whatever fits amount of waves of this roughly intrinsic wavelength. And there's just no way this will scale, and I will find a wave pattern that's 2 centimeters.
question. There's calcium playing an important role here.
Yeah.
And is it exiting as well as entering? I mean,
So calcium is a very strong regulator, so it's quickly taken up again in vesicles in the cytoplasm. So you don't want to have strong, large fluctuations in calcium as a cell.
So it takes up a certain amount of calcium and then it's buffered.
Yes. Yes.
Did I see sort of with the contraction, like you see the flow reversing, right?
Yeah. So, okay. I should have noted. So you have a closed network. So that means that if I take the network and I put it down on a single tube, that the pattern you would think to see is that you have a contraction and this part is expanding, and you have a contraction here and this part is expanding, and so you will have a shuttle flow that's going forth or back. It's actually a nice point that you're pointing this out now. Because in reality, when I said, like, I'm taking the network and I'm mapping it down to a single tube, I'm really oversimplifying a lot. Because as you see in these networks, are actually highly reticulated. So there are lots of loops. So we should actually, and that's why it says closed tube up here, we should also look at loop tubes. So that's what JD did. And indeed, what you all of a sudden find is that you find these data points in the simulation where all of a sudden the wave pattern scales. And JD dig deeper, and what he actually found is if I take a tube, let's say, half the intrinsic wavelengths, and I slowly grow it and have the pattern self-organized as I'm slowly growing it, all of a sudden I can have the system, the dynamic scales up to 7 times the intrinsic wavelengths. And just a rule of thumb, like 7 times the intrinsic wavelengths, that was 7 millimeters, taking that last higher order digits into account, I arrive at a scaling limit of 4.7 centimeters, well within the realm of the 2 centimeters that I've shown you. So what's going on here, actually, note that if I have a closed tube, which are the red dots, this does not happen. So for the red dots, basically, your nonlinear dynamics pattern formation curriculum still fully applies. It's only in the periodic boundaries, so the loop tube. And so basically, what is going on there is that you have a flow boundary condition. You have an extra flow, which is actually oscillatory in nature. We showed that it's the oscillatory part of the flow that is important. And this oscillatory flow feeds directly back into the pattern of the calcium and gives this extra kick to make the pattern scale.
So it's not actually circulation, it's
not the circulation, it's not the, so if you decompose your flow into the net flow and the oscillatory component of the flow, you can basically test that by taking a closed tube and then you put down a boundary condition, basically. What drives scaling is not the amount of the net flow, but it's the oscillatory component. It's the last figure in the paper, which sadly I don't have in the talk, but yeah. Yes?
Can you make now 5-0 bigger than 5 centimeters?
That's an obvious question. So the tricky thing is, it doesn't fit on the mic. I mean, I'm limited basically in the Petri dish, by the Petri dish. That fits under my microscope. And I need the microscope to be able to have access to this huge dynamic range to really read out the contractions. So a simple Canon camera won't do, like, to allow this quantification. So we haven't done that. Because also 4.7 and 10 centimeters, that's, you know, I mean, all the physiological parameters, they're not that well known, so that's just a, you know, rule of thumb. It does look like, though, there's data from Mark Fricker in England, that you do find peristaltic waves also on a scale of 20 centimeters. So I'm not sure how well we are in generating and really predicting the exact size. So it might be like quite a fishing trip to actually go down that road. But what we gain here is really mechanistic insight of how the role of flows really changes our understanding of how patterns can form.
How big can the animal get?
It depends on, it just wants a tumor and it wants food. So 3 meters in length is doable in size. It does not as long as you feed it, it will just keep on growing. I mean, we only grow them big when we do outreach, and we take them these large trays and show, like, look, here's a slime mold. But
the largest documented one is 3 meters.
Yes.
You can probably decompose the graph into cycles in various ways. When you do that, can you superimpose the loop solutions, or is the equation sufficiently nonlinear that you wouldn't expect to be able to add up the loop solutions for different loops and get a total flow?
So what we're looking here, there are two couple PDEs, and solving two couple PDEs on a network is just computational time consuming. So we are actually only looking at them in sort of simple geometries, and we also now, just about a year ago, established methods to, without cutting, actually grow very simple network structures that will. Are very, very small networks. So this is actually the basis that we aim to compare things to. But that was not within the realm of my postdoc.
But this is a mathematical question about the equations. We had, let's say, three adjacent loop solutions that shared a network. Would the size of the nonlinear terms be too large so that you wouldn't expect the solutions to sort of add into a composite flow? Or is that a possible good guess?
So the patterns, the system is constrained by conservation of mass, and so the patterns that will form will adjust, like at least in the small geometries that we explore numerically, to whatever morphology you give it. It's not that the network suppresses the pattern formation that we didn't. Like it never happened. So with that, I would like to. Oh, sorry, wrong forward. To conclude that I have here a system where I observe flows scaling with the size of the network, and that we can understand this unexpected long range scaling with long range coordination by the transport of signal molecules. Now I want to go further and tell you about the role of adaptability. And this is now being a first glimpse where we're asking ourselves, that's now together with my PhD student, Felix Borle, what has to change in these contractions to allow for efficient mass transport? And so the setting that we're doing, and I'm going to play you this this data in a little bit, is that we take a network and we give it a blue light stimulation. And so Fasarum does not like blue light, and when it's hit by blue light, it retracts from that area. And it retracts by really moving its own biomass away. And so the question is,
what's the mechanism?
Oh, so they are phytochromes. So it has multiple, up to five different photoreceptors that are especially strong in the blue light. And so that's the biochemistry understanding of how it's reading out this light information. Sort of nature habitat function is that it likes to be in shady, humid environments to flourish. And blue light is often a good indicator for strong sunlight, and so it avoids these areas. Interesting, though, if it's set to undergo sporulation, so when it, like the slime, these networks, they form like little spores, and then the spores will travel away with the wind. Then it actually likes to be sort of in exposed locations of its environment, just because usually where you have strong light, then hopefully you also have good winds and that will carry the spores away. Then it goes towards the light. So it depends on the culturing addition. But that's actually a very exciting question for cell differentiation, that, you know, how you actually turn the knob of, say, of committing towards sporulation. And it's very interesting because you can show that it's somehow adding up sun exposure hours. So it's somehow capable to do add up actually the time that it got a certain radiation.
So
So in the illuminated region, the cytoplasm leaves the tubes, but the tubes remain?
No. So the cytoplasm leaves, but what's basically left here is slime. So we have this actomycin, and there's a bilayer, and outside that bilayer, we have a slime matrix, and only the slime matrix is left behind. Everything else? Yes. It takes, and so this is, so this data is 3 years ago, 3 years old. We don't do experiments like that anymore, because what you actually see in this grainy structure here is that it was fed by oat flakes, and so we have these oat flake granules that are floating around in the cytoplasm and then also eventually get excreted on the gel. So this is slime highlighted by little granules of oat flake. So now we use liquid culture, and then we don't have to deal with these nuisances for quantitative analysis. So here's the movie. And the blue is just for your guidance, right? It's actually not being superimposed. So now we turn out the blue light, and you see how, over the course of 20 to 40 minutes, this region is really slowly being evacuated, and by really retracting the mass, and then moving it to the periphery of the organism. The mass overall stays pretty good, pretty well constant. So how much control does one tube have in driving this process? So when asking ourselves, we first turn to literature, which I guess you should always do. And what the literature said is that if you give a light stimulus, what's most reproducible is that the shape of the waveform changes under blue light. And so too, this is now a trace from our experiments, where you see how the waveform that probably up to now you had in your mind as a perfect sine or cosine curve actually has a more tilted shape. And as a guide to you, here on the right, I'm actually showing the frequency spectrum of the signal. And what it shows you is that basically I have one bright spot here, that's your dominant frequency. But then you have other bright spots, and these are the overtones. So a little more basic even, so if I would have a pure sine wave, I would have only one frequency, right, yellow spot here. But if I would have, for example, a sawtooth pattern, then I would need these overtones to create this shape. So basically, and we find that really, like if you do the frequency spectrogram of our data sets, we see that it's really dominated by one dominated and one overtone. And frequency to get approximation. So you have these two, and they are able to change the shape. But if you now look at the function, there's actually theoretical work, pre-Ault even, that if you look at the transport generated by peristaltic wave, if you change the shape from a sine to a sawtooth, it doesn't change the pumping efficiency. So what is actually going on? And so to gain understanding what might be going on, we turn to a toy model. And so in that toy model, we basically asked ourselves, what change in pumping efficiency can I achieve when I compare a simple cosine wave to a wave that now, in addition to that simple cosine, has a higher overtone. So that then has twice the frequency. And I'm here also introducing a phase shift of the overtune with respect to the dominant frequency. And that's the base radius. So in the graphs on the right, basically I'm looking at yellow would just be a perfect cosine. And now I'm adding to the perfect cosine, and it's first overtone, and the sum of both of them is then this green curve. And so you see, by adding these two, I change the shape. So the shape doesn't look like a pure sine anymore. Now, to explore what impact that actually has on the pumping, I right now I still have one entirely unknown parameter in this equation, which is the amplitude of the overtone. And so we wanted to constrain this parameter and just said, if I were a living system, and I invest in having an overtone, I may not like to spend extra energy on it, so I constrain this amplitude by keeping the deformation energy of my tube of keeping it constant. And so you do a little math, and that constrains your amplitude. And so then we can really explore the pumping efficiency of the superposition of both of them versus the bits. And so the key insight is that now we only have one parameter left, and that's the phase difference between overtone and dominant frequency. And that's actually very powerful. So here, this is an example where the phase difference is 3 pi over 2. And now I'm shifting this, I'm shifting the yellow curve, shifting the dominant, so such that the phase difference here is pi. And so what you see is that all of a sudden, this green curve goes down much further. So it's not the wave shape itself that matters. What really matters for the pumping is the point of tightest occlusion. And so by taking your sine, your cosine, and adding an overtone, you can align basically the dips of the two minima such that the total dip is deeper. So the occlusion is tighter. And then you can, in this toy model, you can really calculate the flow rate. And it has a strong impact. So this is now the flow rate generated by these peristaltic waves as a function of the phase difference. And you see that it's optimal at pi and goes down at both flex. And indeed, even in the physiological parameter range, where the amplitude of the contractions is just 10% of the radius, which even means that the amplitude of the higher of the overtone, which goes with amplitude square, is even 1%. So it's a small quantity, because the radius goes into the flow rate with a power of 4. It has a strong impact. This occlusion has a strong impact on the pumping efficiency, and so it allows for a 25% increase, even though we're really playing with small numbers. And this toy model most fundamentally helped us to identify a new control parameter, namely the phase difference between overtone and dominant frequency. And so, okay, the next thing is to go into your data and measure it, right? And so Felix was bold enough to really do that. And so what he then did is basically, at every pixel in his network, he filtered the dominant and the overtone, dominant overtone. And then he did a stepwise fitting of the signal in blue to a wave to a sign. And so now you see it over time at one pixel, and you see that over long stretches of time, really the dominant and the overtone, they're in a fixed relationship, phase relationship, and then sometimes they shift and adjust. So we can now really quantify the phase shift between overtone and dominant throughout these data sets. That's what we take. And we wanted to look at light stimuli, but it's always good to have sort of a wild type to compare to, right? And so our wild type was actually to look at a network that doesn't undergo any stimulations, and it's just hanging out there. And so I'm going to show you this first. So here we take a network. It's being cut out like the other ones, and we'll look at it over time. It actually also, just because it's starving, undergoes some relocation of mass, so that phenotype is there. But it wasn't forced by any light. And so now we can quantify this phase difference. And so these are actually multiple data sets with the mean and the variance of the phase difference measured throughout the data set. That's the stack of all of them. Maybe you can just look at the red, which is the mean of all the data sets and its variance. When I said alignment, dominant overtone, the optimum is actually at pi. Okay, here it's at zero. That's like, I don't know, I felt like when we saw this, I was like, yeah, you know, this is like Edward Purcell, right? You know, he does this perfect calculation of, you know, bacterial swimming and how you can, like, be very efficient in swimming, and then you find out that the damn critter is not efficient at all, right? So it's just like us physicists imposing that the system should be optimal, but it's not, right? It's like even optimal. Like, this is the worst pumping that you could do. seriously. So, like, it's the minimal occlusion. Like, if you have both, that's the minimal occlusion. That would be the maximal occlusion. So, But it was good to make this observation because it triggered us to think about other things. And it triggered us to sort of generate the idea, maybe these actin contractions, they're not actually themselves setting up to be a dominant and an overtones themselves. That actually what happens is that the overtone arises due to the feedback of a viscoelastic wall being contracted with just, you know, a sine wave, but then sort of feeding back onto a fluid that also has a pressure and hence also deforms this viscoelastic wall. And so if you just take a viscoelastic elastic tube and you calculate the overtone that would arise due to this coupling of the viscoelastic tube and the pressure, and you calculate the phase shift of the overtone to the dominant, this is where you should be. You can't be anywhere else. So the system may just be mechanically totally constrained if your active forcing is just a sinus, but this is where you should be. And actually, if you put in the physiological parameters in this for the elastic tubes, this is actually where you would find yourself. So it may be perfectly right that it shouldn't be optimal. But I wouldn't be here telling you the story that, you know, if we would find the same thing if we now put down light, right? I mean, that would be a crap story. So now we put down light. And so we put down light. This is looking at all our light experiments before the light hit. So this is a different set of data, but again, the phase difference is close to zero that we see. And now we turn on light, and we average the phase difference in the first 20 minutes and the subsequent 20 minutes, so 0 to 20, 20 to 40, and you see how the phase difference is actually moving towards optimal occlusion.
And the light is illuminating the entire organism?
No, it's always illuminating like a quarter, which is in the center. And so so it does care about being optimal when forced, right? But somehow like alert you into like this idea that you have a viscoelastic tube and the overtone only arises due to the coupling of the fluid and the viscoelasticity. So how does it fit in the picture now that all of a sudden I can actually go into a range that was mechanically not possible? And it turns out if the actin viscoelastic cortex would actually be undergoing stress stiffening, so you have a small nonlinear term, this would exactly be the direction that it would drive you in that phase space. It wouldn't drive you this way, but would perfectly drive you that way. So it's a glimpse of how actually an actin cortex could be a nonlinear viscoelastic material that allows under being forced to drive a single tube to be a much more efficient in pumping by optimizing its occlusion. Yes?
So can you measure rheology in the absence and presence of light?
That's right. No way. You can talk to Manan. Manan was like, was it 2 years ago? I don't know. She really made an effort. Like, we really made an effort to characterize the viscoelasticity. I mean, we're basically using the parameters that we know from other actin cortices, but this is... as best as we can do.
Have you tried to compare what would happen if you eliminated the whole cell?
No, we did not.
And my other thing, question I'm wondering is, how long does this effect last? Do they adapt to the light over time?
Well, basically, in the end, this region is going to be gone. And then, so there's no part of the organism that's still exposed to direct light. And it's a good question. We didn't quantify, but I would assume it to go back as before. So typically, the organism needs like an hour to adjust to environmental changes. So I would expect it to go back to the system as before. Yep. For light, we actually have the data. We didn't quantify it. It's a good question. David.
Do the dead ends play any special role, or does it matter? The fraction of them change under different conditions, as opposed to the reticulations?
I mean, the dead ends arise from the way we prepare the specimen. We cut it, right? And so they will basically, over time, so in the scales now I'm talking like 3 to 5 hours, it will go fans again, like these like continuous structures that you saw crawling along. So
I thought some of your pictures had dead ends in the interior.
This is sort of you see that here. So basically it's starving and it's retracting the mass here. And so the way to retract the mass is to have to these dead ends and then they retract over time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Talking about Myrna. I showed you a story of how really within a single tube there is a lot of control to increase transport flux absorption, which are like other projects in the group, throughout the network. And it's fascinating to think that, you know, given the feedback of flows in the network, there's even a, you know, there's a possibility for self-organized optimization. I won't dig into the details of the role of topology, but just want to say that we're looking at the role of topology in a way at how it can stabilize flow patterns or how loops can increase overall flow. But I would like to seize the last 10-15 minutes to talk about the role of hierarchy. So this is now, well, the before was like submitted or published work. This is now really fresh from the lab, unpublished work, and it's actually Myrna's work, who's taking part of the course. So I'm actually going to show you a movie you've seen before. But now I want you to pay attention close up. So these are bacterial food pellets spread out. There's going to be later on, because here's the rim of the petri dish, and the organism's going to move here. Mona's going to add another one here to lure it back into the middle of the petri dish. What I want you to pay attention now is the morphology of the network. Have a look if you can. So these bacterial pellets, they're teeny. They're entirely going to be consumed by the organism. It just fully takes it up. There won't be any trace left. Have a look how long you can spot the location of this pellet after the organism passed. Taking down the dump. Now the new one hits. What do you see? It's the morphology. Isn't it crazy? It memorizes the location of the food source in the network structure of the morphology.
And the shape.
Yes. So I'm here. Yeah, I'm just highlighting the one where, it was put down. So here, you know, this is totally the location of the food source. It's been entirely consumed, but you can totally read it from the network structure. And it's actually not only at this later point, which is easiest visible, just to drive home that morphology itself can be memory, where you see this newly formed network. It actually already happens here. That the hierarchy, the pattern of bigger and smaller veins changed because there's food here. And so to really, okay, so how does it work, right? So
I'm not sure if I understand what you mean here. Why are you calling it memory and not just a change in morphology induced by the food?
It's because it persists and it can be read out for change in the function of the organism. So the way of how you would describe memory is that you store information, in this case about the location of the food source, and you read out this information to perform functions differently.
So if I cut my arm and I have a scar in the place where I cut my arm, my skin is now functioning differently. Would you call that a memory?
Would it function differently when it healed?
Like, yeah, if you, scar tissue is not the same as the original tissue.
Yeah, yeah, no, but the if you were to cut the that sounds like an awkward argument down the road. But if you were to cut your skin elsewhere, would it respond differently because you have a scar there?
You mean I cut in the same place where it had been cut before?
No, in a different place. You have a cut here, and now you cut like in parallel here, or you cut would the skin respond differently because there was a scar?
In a different location?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know enough about skin biology.
We shouldn't do this.
That every time that they encounter, that their response to the second food pellet is different because there was a previous food pellet?
Yes. So the change, like the structure of the, where you have bigger, so basically the pellet sets down where you have bigger and where you have smaller veins. And the bigger veins are your highways, and the smaller veins are your country roads. And the way it will respond to a new food source strongly depends on the location of the bigger and the smaller veins. So even though I'm giving a different stimulus at a different location, it's reading out the information about the previous location because it's mapped into the change in the morphology. So
in the same way as we can become used to different foods, if I eat a certain type of food today and I eat that every day for a while, then you introduce some new food later on, my response to that food may be different than yours if you weren't.
It's not like it's been shown that you have habituation for like chemical concentrations, but I think this is different. It's not because it's not that you. I mean. It's not habituation. Like you don't give the same stimulus over and over again, and it will change the way it will respond to it. But you give different stimuli, and it even affects this very different stimuli at a different location.
So Karen, could you show the movie again? I just want to make sure I understand the phenomena that is capturing your attention. So here it comes. Okay, so I see a beautiful thick network around the shape of the oak flake. Mm-hmm. That's one thing we're supposed to notice.
Yes.
Okay, but then it seems to forget in the sense that
eventually,
it moves away and then you no longer star heals, so to speak. And presumably that big, thick network that surrounds the oak flake helps it absorb the nutrient from the oak flake.
I hope so. I have no idea. I don't know. Yeah.
That would be reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, this movie, these are 3 hours, so a lot of, 3 days, sorry, 3 days, so a lot of happening on that one. But it's more a teaser to show that actually even on this scale, this in this time range, you will see a change in the morphology that is anisotropic and triggered by the food stimulus and persists over long scales. If I were to put down a new stimulus, the change in the morphology would be yet different. And it's in a way like how when I gave the example of your blood vasculature having different low flow velocity after the clogging. You can say I just changed it, but I would say like it has memorized this clogging event. So that's the same. It's the same language.
Well, I guess the issue of Cassandra is that I can find that what you call this persistence.
Yes, okay.
Persist. I think that memory has a component of functionality of that persistence.
Yeah, that's what that's
obvious
what,
now.
That's
what you are showing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That it's because it changes the network morphology, it has direct impact on the immediate function of the
but
network.
You are not yet naming what is this direct impact.
Well, I showed you in the very, like I remember when I said, like, I'm going to do a detour because I want you to pay attention to looking at the transport capabilities of a network with homogeneous tube radii and one that actually had bigger and smaller veins. And you could strikingly see that the transport capabilities of this network are much, is much different.
I understand that, but is this change any advantage for what happened in the subsequent clip? The dynamics are different because if you persist, that structure is there, and that structure
it changes
has an influence in what happens.
It has an influence.
It has an influence, but is it an advantageous influence in the behavior of the next?
Yeah, well,
that is the point. Then you call this memory because it has a function, it's used for something.
It's used for something at being better of having it. That's basically what you're saying.
Yeah.
So because it's definitely used for function because the morphology directly impacts the function.
I don't think it has to be a better function. We have nightmares all the time about the words that we are choosing help us because we have an intuition about a mechanism or an underlying explanation, and I'm trying to understand what is your idea about the mechanism here that memory helps you to get out.
Elliot has an opinion.
It seems to me it's the same as synaptic facilitation in the brain. Right? You increase the communication between certain neurons based on experience, and that changes the network. So if that's memory, this is memory.
Also, Karen, did you just show that later? So you can change the direction by which you can find the food, right? So that next one it's going to eat was always there, but it couldn't find it before, but now it's in the direction.
Yeah.
So
it can. More opinions about semantics?
Well, if the food pellets were clustered, then there'd be a clear functional advantage, and you could test that.
Yes. So I mean, we're right now, like, what happens since, I mean, this was a tedious experiment that Mona did, because she basically stayed next to it to make sure that it stayed humid 3 days. So now we have an incubation chamber that makes it much easier. and so we're taking more of this data. But for now, I want to tell you that we can actually learn a lot about what actually facilitates this change in the network hierarchy already when looking at just a basically more or less static network and just looking at the dynamics here. And I will just, I'll take all your thoughts into consideration when moving forward with this project, but for the moment, I will just keep to the jargon, just because that's the jargon that I have in my mind, but I'll keep it into consideration. So now we do a much more controlled experiment, which is minimal. So now we take a network that is static, and we actually look at the response of a pellet that we put down. Note it's outside of the network. And so we look at the response of this organism, of this network, and so basically the pellet was put down just after this frame. So the next frame, the pellet is put down, and we're looking at the morphology 35 minutes later. And so if you just look at which tubes grow and shrink, you see that there's a region very close by that tremendously grew. But I want you to pay attention mostly to this area, because fascinatingly enough, they didn't grow the same rate. But the tubes that were bigger in the beginning sort of also grew more, whereas the others actually even shrunk. So this stimulus actually increased the hierarchy in favor of this stimulation directed towards the stimulus.
So growth is change of diameter, or what is growth?
Yes, diameter. So, you know, invoking our trick to go via in intensity of transmitted light, but you can actually correlate them, and you know they perfectly correlate. So yes, it's using that trick. It's the diameter.
So the rightmost picture is an analysis of the middle picture.
It's that 35 minutes minus 0 minutes.
It's a change.
It's a change. Yeah, it's a relative growth,
right,
compared to the tube size before. So it's basically delta tubes, and so basically the stimulus changes the hierarchy. And it would have, like, sadly, you can't just prepare the same network all over again, right? It's not like you have an E. coli and you can just, like, they're all the same. Or the networks are all the same. But it would have been different if you put down a stimulus here, basically.
So if the city gets busy, you add lanes to the interstate, and people use the country roads less. And so it's forever different.
Yeah. This is just, you know, the hierarchy changes. But actually, what are the dynamics, right? And so now I'm going to show you.
But you say that there's only diameter change. It seems that you just have many more tubes.
No, it's the same amount. Oh, what?
Yes, if you look on the top part, it seems to have many more tubes.
So
it's not a matter of diameter. It's a matter of number of tubes that grow.
What we do is we fix the network at that stage. In the way we analyze the data, we only look at the dynamics of those tubes that are already existing at that time point and look at how they change. I'm not taking into account new ones that have grown here or for example down here. So, I mean, this is a biological specimen, so lots of things are always going on. And you will actually appreciate that in the next movie, that there are lots of basal dynamics. So I'm just looking at what happened to those tubes that were existing before.
That's why the colorful network is smaller than the...
Yes, indeed. So to be honest, basically, Mona actually fixed it way before that time point. like the initial time of the data set rather than that one, which, you know, as I said, work in progress.
If you give even food everywhere, does the size of the tube equalize?
Oh, if you give... I would not expect that. I mean, yes, we do have data where we give food on multiple sites. You will always build highways towards the food. So the only thing that you can do is like grow it on nutritious agar, and then you will have a
mess.
A mess. So you will have just a continuous no network structure. If it's like happy with food, it will just like nyum, and that's it. But it will always form a network. Always increase the hierarchy. So dynamics. So here now, I'm going to show you the instantaneous dynamics of all tubes. So it's like looking at the gradients of the diameter. Does it dilate, spread, or shrink? I'm going to start the movie now. 35 minutes before the stimulus actually hits. You will see when the stimulus hit, because there's going to pop up a red dot here to indicate now. And the reason why I'm showing you the data, the dynamics before, is to highlight that there is actually a lot of basal growth and shrinkage dynamic going on independent of
the
stimulus.
And the red dot is the center of mass of the plate?
Yeah, roughly. So there's some, you know, basal dynamics that are going on. And now we put down the... You see the front growing. Oh, the rest of the thing is shrinking. And then you see this dilation actually propagating into the network. Did you see how it's taking the highways to dilate first? So they're two... here you see it. Like later on, it sort of goes back to like, not caring too much. So there's a period where the network really has tubes, certain tubes grow, others shrink, and then it goes back to the spatial dynamics. Yes.
So here you're not
no stimulus.
The new ones.
No stimulus. No, I'm not tracking the new ones. Stimulus. Red. Blue. Red, this becoming white, propagating in. So there are two things to keep in mind. A, if I have a region of the network that's dilating, the fluid volume on these timescales is conserved. So the rest of the network has to shrink. Because, you know, you can't, like if you draw a fluid at one place, it has to come from somewhere. So that's why when this turns bright red, as an immediate response, the rest turns blue. Other thing, second point is this front propagating in. I mean, you kind of learned the lesson by now. I suppose, again, it's the speed by which molecules would be attracted with the fluid flow. And they are basically they're making use of the highways that exist from the side of the stimulus location and increase the hierarchy. You can even like take this whole data set and you can classify the dynamics into just three stereotyped behaviors of the tubes. So this is like automated classification. So the tubes either do one of three things. And this is now over time, this is when the stimulus hits. You can already see that the tubes, what they do sort of depends in this case also on the initial diameter a little bit. So basically you have these tubes that are close to the stimulus site. When they get the stimulus, they grow. When these grow and dilate, the other ones shrink, conservation of mass. But then you see how the red ones grow, and at a later time point, if I just take the point of spider, highest, dead spider. The highest gradient, this one is earlier than that one. Right? This is because it's propagating with the flow. Further, you see that after a certain point, this dilation sort of levels out again. Note that this leveling out actually happens on different timescales as well. So that's why the hierarchy persists, because the dynamics happen on different timescales. Here, it even takes really long. Now, so what? How can we reconcile this? What is going on so that this hierarchy is being established? So again, we have apparently transport of a signaling molecule, and it seems to be softening the tubes when once it reaches them. Like this, these are immediately reached. That's why they dilate immediately, and these are reached later. But then it degrades. So maybe the signaling molecule is also being degraded over time. So that's why it sort of goes back. And so just to, yes?
So you said that the volume of water is conserved. Is that true only on short time scales or also on large time scales? Can they regulate the amount of water?
So it's conserved on a time scales of 2 hours, I would say. And then you start, like, even when you're, like, in the movie of the previous data set where it was just pruning, it was pruning in the center, but it was actually moving most of the mass towards the rim. So the mass was still actually more or less conserved. And that's without similar pruning data set, that was even 4 hours.
And so you get this just by integrating the water content.
Yeah, so I can just look at the amount of material, like just by gray values, sum them up. Yeah. And that's,
And where do you think the nutrients are being metabolized? Are they, is it like peristalsis that's trying to get them uniformly distributed as the whole organism from one side by having these periodic contractions? Yeah.
So what is happening on top of, so here I'm really looking at the changes in the morphology. Yeah. What is happening on top is also that the phase pattern is rearranging. So actually in this data set is a pretty isotropic in shape. So you actually have all kinds of phase patterns. It's not just the peristaltic nave locks in along the longest axis if you have an anisotropic shape. Here we don't have that, so it's actually like there's lots of swirling around and there's very complex phase patterns in this data set. What happens for the first, I would say, 20 minutes here is actually that you have the phase pattern reorienting to also enhance the transport from that side in. But then it sort of breaks down again and sort of like goes back into like whirling around. So the phase pattern does not persist. The phase pattern is only transiently adapting, whereas the change in hierarchy really persists on much longer time scales.
Your highways in this case already were oriented. Yeah. So I just was wondering what would have happened if the flake was in the right side.
See, now you pick me as a lazy person in preparing this talk, because there is another data set and that Myrna has, and I didn't put it in. That's my fault. So it's a data set where we have an elongated network, and she puts down two stimuli across the short axis, and you see that really the tubes, even though they are even small, that are close along the shortest path linking these two, they are the ones that are growing.
Exactly, because at the moment you are formulating the equation of the issue in terms of the highways.
Yes.
But the other thing I see is that this is actually parallel to the direction.
Yeah, yes, I agree. And I mean, the other data set preceded that one and sort of triggered us to really quantify. But then basically, how well you can be in like really quantifying the dynamics of the contraction sort of depends a little bit on the age of the organism. So the other one was a little older, and so didn't like, you know, it's like, you know, you do, I don't know, 15 experiments to have that one really nice one. So that's basically what's going on. But yes, exactly.
But the animal will still, I mean, when it's searching for food, it will probably put them parallel to the food, right, or along this axis because it's looking for the food.
It will always strengthen the tubes towards the stimulus because it will grow eventually this way. Yes. So whenever it found a food source, it kept like moving across that food source and kept walking in that direction. It's a little bit like on a coarse grain scale, it's a self-avoiding rainbow, right? In a sense, so it will persist once it found food in that direction for a bit. So just to drive home that this simple concept of having that this change in hierarchy is actually can be explained by putting down that the stimulus releases a softening agent, and that softening agent is being attracted with the fluid flow and degraded over time, but then, you know, softens the tube, actually can explain these dynamics. And so this is now a simple model where at one time here, we release a chemical and we look at the response of the tube further and further away from the stimulus. And so so it's really chemical tailor, you know, it's being affected as before, all the moves that you saw. And the only thing that would change is that now the elastic stress of the tube, the elastic modulus changes as a function of the concentration. And so you see that immediately the region close by dilates rapidly, the rest shrinks, and then successively the further and further you go down, they dilate and eventually go back to zero. And that embeds the hierarchy.
Is it important for the model that the mechanism of agent movement be advection as opposed to anything else?
It could be diffusive, but that would be much slower. If it would be much slower, then I guess the timing wouldn't pan out. It could be that then, so basically it's how much concentration do you get as a relative to the degradation of your chemical. So if it's just diffusive, it might be degraded before it actually reaches the end of the network.
And so you chose advection because only advection sets gives you this prediction?
No, we chose advection because this is what the organism is operating on. But it's a model, and so we could explore it. Mm-hmm. My intuition would tell me that if you decrease flow velocity, then you would see a response in this one, but these two might not respond at all anymore because it's been degraded until nothing will be reached there. So with that, to conclude, so the hierarchy of the network is a mean to store information about the history of events, findings, food sources, and it's now fascinating to really think about how this memory or, you know, information storage is actually helping the organism to function and to solve problems. And that said, that Fizaramine itself basically got its fame for being amazing in solving problems like the traveling salesman problem or finding the shortest path through the maze and all these things. But last but not least, I would love to thank you as a very interactive audience, but primarily my group and Göttingen. Lots of over actually the course of the by now 4 years that I've been in Göttingen. Honestly, the Max Planck Institute, because it's a great environment to just explore ideas and do crazy things. I mean, I should state that I'm a theoretical physicist, and I worked in the lab, but was never an experimental postdoc at Harvard. So they gave me the opportunity to just build my own lab and just do it, and you learn best by doing. And for sure, funding agencies. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Sorry. You have this agent softening tube model, but it's a 1D model, right?
Yeah.
But then I was thinking, how you have this highway instead of like a group of small highways instead of like two highways. You might need some stage instability to say, okay, why do I only want those two instead of like six of them? I don't know if that actually makes sense.
So if like the amount of highways makes a difference on the response?
I saw initially you have like tons of tubes opening, right?
Yeah.
But then they turn into those two highways, so there's a sheer decrease in the height.
Oh, the highways were there before. So so there were morphologically bigger veins, and so the bigger veins have higher flow velocity, and so they just basically are the ones where the, because they have higher flow compared to the highways compared to the country roads, they get more of the signaling molecule, and so that's why they respond. But as I said, if you put up a setting where you put the stimuli such that they don't have a highway they can hatch on, they will still go use the flows that are there, and they will still reach the ones that are closest by, and then they turn into highways later on, which is in response to Marco's question.
So it is possible to turn the highway network completely by 90 degrees if you do a full particle.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. guess patchy food sources are a standard thing in ecological theorizing, at least, maybe yes. observations. Well, and you could relate that, as I suggested, to the what you were calling memory, the building up of the veins right around an existing food source, and also to the orientation of the major channels towards food sources, but in that case, and therefore the persistence of the migration direction, that would make sense for a patchy food source.
Yep.
But in that case, there's a competing hypothesis, such as the major size vein could also just be good for feeding the rest of the organism, for bringing the nutrients you've already discovered back.
So, basically, if you have a very unhappy organism, very unhappy, like unhappy in like being very deprived of food, it will form a tree structure and only have big veins. But this is basically its rescue mechanism. And as long as it's not super unhappy, that it has moderately fat, you will see that it will always maintain, will basically try to have a large area when foraging and have. So the hierarchy is least for a highly nutritious state and becomes more hierarchical for being food deprived.
Right, but I was thinking of the state variable to be explained as the orientation of the major veins, and in that case there are two competing things. One is you want to keep going past the food source you found because you expect food to be patchy, and the other is you want to feed all the mouths that are depending on it.
So as I said, like we have lots of data by now because of this new technical addition. Elliot.
So is this the same thing that happens when you get a mosquito bite and your capillaries dilate and it brings material to, not away from this point?
I had no idea. This is what that the mosquito bite is affecting my capillaries. It might be. I have no idea.
It's swelling up. It must be doing something.
Could well be. I have no idea.
It's traffic too, though. I mean, it's bringing something too.
I will have a different look the next time I have a mosquito bite. This feels,
So you've shown you have more efficient transportation when you have big and small tubes.
Yes.
I mean, tubes with different diameter compared to having tubes with similar diameter, right? Or in other words, if you had all tubes with huge diameter, will that be the best? Is it a matter of having tubes of diverse diameter, or is it a matter of having an average bigger tubes?
So theoretically it's a hard problem that's not been solved. I'm just going to show you. Okay, this one more slide. So actually, this pruning data set that I showed you before, we quantified it in a way that we looked at what is the capability of dispersed particles around in this morphology versus the one that's been starved. And here you see, like, only big veins, small ones taken away, grown on the periphery. And so just having these in the center, these highways only, you basically funnel the flow to the only existing connections. So the flow rate is much higher here all of a sudden. And so you're much better at dispersing from that area. But this is because these are in the center. If they're in the back, it would be different, because you have a peristaltic wave, flows, this is a boundary. The flows have to be zero at the boundary, and they are always highs in the center. So you really have, from this, it's a fun and challenging theoretical problem. How does the hierarchy, the topology of the network impact transport, dispersion? You have competition of advective and diffusive transport. It's just not solved. And basically, bit by bit, by doing theory and experiment at the same time, we're sort of trying to gain ideas of how we can actually solve the problem, which is not only our vasculature, right? I mean, there's so many engineering problems that actually rely on tubing, like porous networks, right? I mean, this is basically any chemical reaction industrially will happen in a bead pack reactor. So you have the same problem. You have a tubular network. It's just a challenge.
More question. All right, I keep thinking of all these analogies, but I want to ask, when the thing retracts and it's going towards a food source, it's transporting all the materials in it, the lipid membrane and all this stuff away. So is it optimizing retreat or advance? Suppose you had an army going over a marshy area and they had pontoon bridges in a certain fixed
moment. Yeah, I know what you mean.
You wanted to retreat really fast, you would do this. If you wanted to advance really fast, well, maybe you'd do the same thing, I'm not sure. But you might dispose the pontoon bridges differently to drain.
I see Myrna rapidly scribbling notes.
All right. I mean, I think it's like the cashier line at Trader Joe's, but we can come back to that.